two friends taking pictures of the rising full moon on a summer night.
Two teenage kids doing what teenage kids do.
When a stranger with a gun and a death wish changed everything.
It was violent, it was senseless, and I will never understand it, I will never accept it.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and unfortunately, we're all too familiar with stories about how violence shatters lives. But what we rarely see is how they are rebuilt. In a new podcast, The Letter, we relive tragedy, but only so we can hear the rest of the story. The struggle to reclaim lives, the realities of grief, and the possibilities of forgiveness.
I believe in miracles. Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Dave and DeGenevieve, a new conversation.
All right, here we go.
On KSL News Radio, 102.7 FM and 1160 AM.
Nearly 10 years after Sherry Black was murdered in her bookstore in South Salt Lake, the Salt Lake County District Attorney, Sim Gill, filing aggravated murder charges against a suspect who's been in police custody now for a couple of weeks. And we are learning a lot more about how the case might have been cracked, Dave.
Yeah, DNA that was surreptitiously acquired, says the DA. We're going to dive into what that means with investigative reporter Dave Cawley. And later we're going to hear from Sim Gill about how often DNA helps crack the cases he prosecutes.
I want to catch everybody up on this story. I've been following it for many, many years. But it's unfortunate that we tend to lose track of these stories as they go unsolved for years and years and years. So we've got these aggravated murder charges that have now been filed against a 29-year-old and now a defendant in the case by DA Sim Gill. And KSL News Radio's Paul Nelson has more details.
Sherry Black was reportedly stabbed at least 20 times, so there was plenty of physical evidence left behind at the murder scene.
Fingerprints, a palm print, and DNA.
But Salt Lake County DA Sim Gill says it didn't match anything in their felony database. In 2016, lab technicians made a snapshot profile from that DNA. Genealogists made a family history, and that led police to investigate Adam Durbero. Gill says they were able to get a DNA sample from Durbero without him knowing. That matched, plus
his fingerprints and palm print matched the bloody fingerprints and palm print collected at the scene.
Paul Nelson, KSL News Radio.
All right, I want to take you back 5 years ago, 2015, and then I did a story for KSL TV on the five-year mark of her murder. And at the time, police had been running a familial DNA search, hoping they'd find something in a genealogy database to closely match Dave. But back then, 5 years ago, they came up empty on that. So it makes me wonder a couple of different things here with the DNA, and we're going to talk about the word surreptitiously in just a moment with Dave Cawley as well, is did somebody in the family, it could be a cousin, a second cousin, get a DNA swab test kit for Christmas? You know, those test kits everybody's sending in to these websites and send it in, and then they got a hit after 2015 on it?
Yeah, it's so interesting, Debbie, and how many of us know a family member that's done this? My brother did. He absolutely did. So,
You got a test kit for Christmas?
Got the DNA test, sent it in. We got the profile back. We went through the entire thing. It was like a family party because we thought it was so interesting. And now we're starting to see that these things are being used to link cases, criminal cases.
The Golden State Killer in California was tracked through a genealogy database. But I'm also curious about the fingerprint issue. You heard DA Sim Gill address it yesterday in the news conference. Why could they not, with this person who had been in custody for other crimes, why could they not have matched his fingerprints from the scene that they have to fingerprints in law enforcement databases? That seemed to me to be a faster way to get to a suspect than going through a 10-year DNA process. Should we bring in Dave Cawley, investigative reporter?
Yeah, absolutely.
Good morning, Dave.
Hey, good morning.
Surreptitiously, That's a mouthful.
Syrup on your pancakes?
There you go. What is D.A. Gill talking about?
Well, so basically, you have a right as a person under the Constitution to be secure in your person and premises. The police just can't come take your DNA without any kind of warrant, basically.
Right.
And we see that happen in criminal cases all the time. If you are suspected of a crime, they might go to the court and get a judge to sign a warrant where they can come and swab your cheek, test your DNA. In this case, when they say surreptitious, basically what they're saying is you're out in public. And we don't know.
To a mall food court.
Yeah, exactly.
To a mall food court, Dave. I'll just pull in the blanks. And you tossed your stuff away or you handed it off to a person you thought was a janitor to throw away. And it was really an undercover detective.
And the saliva that you left on the rim of that Starbucks cup. Guess what? That's got your DNA on it. We don't know specifically yet in this case what precisely they use, but when they say surreptitious, that's what they're talking about.
And I've seen enough CSI Miami to realize, yeah, you drop it, your garbage out on the road, now all of a sudden we can go dumpster diving. But I look at this story, and I thought this was one of those cases. It was obviously high profile. Sherry Black was, I think, the mother-in-law of Utah Jazz CEO Greg Miller, the Miller family, which we know so well. And I just thought this story would never be told, never be solved. So the DNA, Dave, is there a murky area? Is this something that's going to be challenged in courts? Is this going to be problematic, do you think, in the future?
You know, we don't know specifically who in Adam Durbrow's family they contacted and worked their way back from. Certainly, if I were a defense attorney, I would be looking for any gap there. But the DNA tells a pretty clear story. And if they are able to match, now that they have Adam Durbrow's specific DNA and they've compared that to what was taken at the scene, one would assume that as long as the science was done correctly there, that's really strong evidence. Where this gets murky, though, is, Deb, you mentioned the Golden State Killer case. There's another high-profile case, the Bear Brook case, even here in Utah, the Clearfield serial rapist. These are all cases that have been solved with this kind of forensic genealogy. The problem is these companies that are collecting this DNA information from us all are increasingly reticent to allow police to use their databases for these purposes. And so when you hear Sim Gill in this press conference yesterday talk about this process, you'll notice he does not specifically say if this is, what company they're working with.
Well, Dave, and I think the initial concern or the concern that I was reading about a few years ago was that it was just the police were blanketly using these databases, these familial genealogy databases to search, as opposed to, getting whatever warrant they needed and getting a judge to sign off on it and approaching the companies that way. But I am curious, can I just ask about the fingerprints? Do we know yet why Durbrow, since they had the fingerprints from the scene during their investigation in 2010, why weren't they able to match it in a law enforcement database of fingerprints?
Reporters pressed Sim Gill on this yesterday, and he defended the work of the detectives in the case. Deb, you and I know, Dave, we've looked at this, we've talked about this before on your show, that there were multiple instances where Adam Durbrow was in the criminal justice system where he would have been printed. In fact, he probably had his DNA taken as a juvenile. That should have been in the database. Why did that not match? We don't have good answers for that. But they do say in their charging document that, the prints that were taken from Sherry Black's shop do match Durbrow's now.
Dave Cauley, thank you so much for joining us.
2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
She was tear-gassed and beaten.
Images of thousands desperate to escape Taliban oppression filled our news feeds. More than 80,000 Afghans made it to America. But the story didn't end there.
It was very cold. There was no power, no heat.
Who would help our newest neighbors? I'm Andrea Smartin. In Stranger Becomes Neighbor, you'll hear the stories of some remarkable refugees who left their homes and their dreams behind, only to start over from zero.
Their only possession was three blankets.
And you'll meet Americans who stepped up to help them.
You want me to come when you deliver your baby.
What can one person do in the face of an international disaster decades in the making? That's Stranger Becomes Neighbor. Find us at kslpodcast.com. Follow us on Apple Podcasts or anywhere else you listen.
Dave and the Gentlemen.
I'll admit it. I've been speculating on how the DNA was surreptitiously acquired by investigators. There was a match, according to DA Sim Gill, and to a suspect in a 10-year-old unsolved homicide. The victim of that homicide, Sherry Black, in South Salt Lake. But DNA definitely connected the dots between the murder scene and now the defendant, according to police.
The district attorney is going to join us in just a few moments. And then there's the family DNA tests, genetic genealogy. We learned more about that this morning and about how it's used to find suspects.
Well, so let's start here. The Golden State Killer, California. I cannot remember, Dave, off the top of my head, how many decades this man eluded police. But eventually, genealogy caught up to him and advancements in technology. We've got big companies like 23andMe and Ancestry. But they don't allow police to just rifle through their records, at least not without some sort of a subpoena or a judge-authorized search warrant. And that's according to what the stories I've seen on, PBS. And then we've got other sites, and I think it's called GEDmatch. I don't know. Some of our genealogy friends, our listeners, will probably correct me on that, but it's GEDmatch. They have millions and millions of DNA profiles. Which has been used to crack cases as well. So there's a lot of people who are getting these DNA test kits as Christmas gifts or birthday gifts. You don't need to send me one. That's fine. I don't want one. And not because of this. I just haven't been that interested in it. But this is what's being used to connect the dots. And sometimes it's not directly to the suspect themselves, but close family members.
Yes. It seems like a great tool, a great resource, much like cell phones have become a great resource for law enforcement to track the travels of people. This seems like another great tool if used appropriately. Salt Lake County District Attorney Sim Gill joins us right now on the line. Thank you so much for joining us. We have to ask about the Sherry Black case. Investigators found fingerprints, palm prints, and DNA at the scene. Why wasn't there a fingerprint match until now if the suspect had a criminal history?
Well, you know, that all depends on the robustness of your data at the time that your process, whether there is a centralized database that can feed into that. Remember, CODIS information is also done on both. You have to have a previous felony conviction, and then it has to be something that local law enforcement has a robust enough program to log that information in. In this case, those elements were not there, and this was really an issue that was a collaborative effort, which really required some on the ground, good old-fashioned police work to connect the dots and to do the due diligence work that was necessary to develop those leads and work it. So while we can talk about DNA and other things which are scientifically certain to us to give us the kind of certainty we want to go forward, it was really a lot of good old-fashioned police work that ultimately identified, created the situations in which we could then gather the additional information to file our charges.
Sim, a lot of people might not know off the top of their head what CODIS is, but it's a really critical database, and I believe it's an FBI database, if my days as a spokesperson of the FBI, if my memory serves. At least it's housed with the FBI. But this is used quite often, right? Is it just for DNA or just for fingerprints?
For DNA, because, you know, you have, for example, a lot of the places where CODIS has been really helpful, Deb, has been in the area of sexual assaults, right? Because often there is DNA that is found there. And that's why, for example, testing rape kits is so important, even when you don't know the person and getting those processed. Because, we solved almost a 30-year-old homicide a few years back. And it was because the DNA that we had here ultimately ended up with a match many years later with a person in Florida who had been caught on an allegation of a sexual assault and convicted. And once his DNA was loaded up in CODIS, we were able to make that connection to a 30-year-old homicide. So it's a tool that's available, and if it's followed up, it can yield some incredible results. But if a person is either not logged in or flying under the radar, as the Sherry Black case sort of demonstrates, it is really connecting those leads and those dots to narrow the field down to a suspect on good probable cause, and then we're developing that case from there.
Well, I'm thinking back in my memory bank, the late 90s, a 10-year-old girl in Salt Lake City was murdered and found dead outside of her home, Anna Palmer. I mean, the name is, you know, known to a lot of people in law enforcement circles and reporters who were around back then. And that case went unsolved for many, many years. And I just did a quick Google search, Sim. Again, my memory was turned out to be right, that was solved through DNA. And I believe the suspect was in jail at the time that the match was made.
Right, and also keep in mind that even DNA techniques have evolved. So, for example, it was the YSTR that we mentioned in our probable cause statement, which was not something that was available 10 years ago. So that's even a much more sharper focus. And a much more granular focus on the DNA. So even DNA techniques are evolving. And even though you may have samples from the old days, but sometimes you need some of those samples to run with some of the newer technologies to be able to match that up as well. So this is an evolving field there. And I know I sound like a broken record here, but those are tools and technology, but it really is good police work. And the team here, our law enforcement team here, Detective Ben Pender and those other folks, the UPD, Sheriff's Department, South Salt Lake, this was without many leads there, but they did not give up. It was going back with fresh perspective, continuing to work this case. As we mentioned in our probable cause statement, the DNA the phenotyping, the genealogist was able to provide a broad familial tree, but that doesn't necessarily give you the needle. It just shows you where the barn is, and then you have to go to that barn to have the haystack to then search for that needle. And that's really just good old-fashioned police work.
But it helps you zero in, right, Sim? And I
yes,
know we have like
absolutely.
10 seconds left. It helps you zero in.
It tells you which farm and which barn to look at. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Do we need checks on using some of these databases?
Of course. Of course. I think absolutely. I mean, the CODIS requirement of a felony level conviction entering into it, I think is a good balance between the competing interests and people's individual rights. Absolutely.
Sim Gill, thank you so much for joining us. The Salt Lake County District Attorney giving us really a great insight, Debbie, in how law enforcement works and really the progress that is being made. This DNA database being used appropriately is a game changer, and I love it.
2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
There's desperation and anguish.
More than 80,000 Afghans have since arrived in America, but this story is still unfolding. I'm Andrea Martin. In my new podcast, Stranger Becomes Neighbor, we'll find out what happens to these new arrivals in our communities. Who would help our newest neighbors? Follow us at kslpodcast.com, Apple Podcasts, or anywhere else you listen.